Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Welcome back to Berlin Inside Out. Well, a very special edition of Berlin Inside Out from the Lennart Meri Conference in Tallinn, the first Talk of the Town session of Tallinn Inside Out. I'm delighted to be joined here by three people I consider friends as well as colleagues, Matthew Kroenig, Mikhail Baranovsky, and Yevgenia Garba. Can you please introduce yourselves to our listeners? Yevgenia.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having us today. I work for the Marshall Center, though here I'm representing only my personal opinions, but now I'm based in Germany, so I can speak both from German and from Ukrainian's perspective.
Excellent. Thank you. Mikhail, tell us about yourself.
Well, it's first of all great to be back in Tallinn. I'm a managing director of GMF East, German Marshall Fund of the United States. I'm based in Warsaw and really taking care of the eastern flank of the alliance.
Thanks very much. Matt, our transatlantic guest.
Yes. Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm Matt Kroenig. I'm vice president and senior director of the Atlantic Council Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. So I oversee a nonpartisan 40-person team doing global strategy and security. I'm also a tenured full professor at Georgetown University.
Super. Thank you. Mikhail, let me come to you first. You were on the opening panel last night here at the Lennart Meri Conference, which traditionally acts as the scene setter for the and the tone setter for the rest of the event. And you were on that panel together with Prime Minister Kaja Kallas and Commissioner Vera Jourova, among others. What were your key messages that you'd like to send to our listeners from that panel, your key takeaways?
First, let me say that it's always great fun to be on a panel with Prime Minister Kallas and, of course, Commissioner Jourova and President of Iceland, whom I never met before. So it was a great conversation. For folks that haven't seen it, you're missing out. Please go and see it, especially, again, Prime Minister. Well, the theme of the discussion was whether Europe is waking up, given the war in Ukraine, to European defense, to transatlantic responsibilities that we need to take on growing our European capabilities. And I would say the message that I wanted to bring, but I think other speakers brought as well, is even though we have made progress, we are perhaps not waking up at the speed of relevance. We are in the second year of the war. We should be doing much more than we are doing right now when we are looking at our defense capabilities, when we are doing at the relations with industry. Russia is going to be able to continue the war for a while. We have an important election coming up in our most important ally, United States, that will also put up some question mark. So these were the main themes, and I think I was bringing, as the only think tanker on the panel, the message of glass still half empty, needed to be filled up.
Thanks, Mikhail. I mean, all this talk of Europe waking up, the alarm calls, maybe they've been heeded, maybe Europe is waking up, but we haven't got out of bed yet, have we, Matt?
Not quite. And this morning I was on a panel on a new arms race. And my main message, because one of the other participants was saying, well, arms races are dangerous and destabilizing. And I said, an arms race isn't the worst possible outcome. The worst possible outcome is that we leave ourselves vulnerable to our adversaries and we have a deterrence failure. And so I think we're not where we need to be in terms of NATO's defense capabilities. And I think the Europeans need to do more, but I also think the United States needs to do more. And again, I'd rather have an arms race than a deterrence failure.
I thought this was such an important point, and we should point out that discussion was on under the Chatham House rule, which, of course, as we know, means you can't be quoted, but you can be fired. But thankfully, Matt agreed to speak to us in public about this too. And I thought the point that you raised, saying in essence, talk of arms races might be dangerous. Arms races might be dangerous, but what's a whole lot more dangerous is losing that arms race if we don't recognize we're in it. So what do we do in concrete terms to actually get ahead of that game and make sure we're in pole position?
Well, let me speak to the nuclear piece first, because I think when people think about an arms race, they often think of the nuclear arms race from the Cold War. And I was recently appointed by the U.S. Congress to serve on a commission reviewing U.S. strategic posture, and we provided our recommendations to Congress in October. So bipartisan panel, 12 people, unanimous recommendations. And essentially, we call for the first strategic arms buildup in the United States since the end of the Cold War to plan to buy more nuclear submarines, more nuclear bombers, to develop and deploy additional non-strategic nuclear weapons in Europe and the Indo-Pacific, and for the first time for the United States to develop a missile defense system for Russia and China. So I think that's what we need to do at the strategic level. The report didn't get a lot of attention, unfortunately. It came out October 12th, just after the October 7th attacks. So doing what I can to bring attention to this, because I think it will be important for the deterrence of the free world.
100%. Well, fear not, Matt. Now that you're on Berlin Side Out or Tal Inside Out, I'm sure the word will rapidly spread. But Yevgenia, that kind of talk is a world away from what we hear in Germany.
Yes, absolutely. But that's something I can totally relate to, because my argument from the very beginning has been that probably bilateral escalation is not good, but what is worse is unilateral escalation. So when Russia is escalating and the West is trying to de-escalate, that's not going to work. And that's what we're seeing now. So far, it hasn't worked well. So probably we need to have a new, much bolder strategy. That's exactly why I like the idea of this year's conference. Let us not despair, but act, because despite some of the tactical advances in Ukraine and some of the tactical successes Russia has, we need to act. We need to take bolder steps, and we need to have a very clear-eyed strategy for a long war.
We do, but it's a delicate balance to strike, isn't it, between waking people up to the severity of the threats we face, the dangers that we are in, without allowing that to become a council of despair and becoming too doomy. So we need to actually somehow draw the idea that we can act. So in concrete terms, and we're going to be talking about this with Elliot Cohen and with Tim Snyder later on, as well as with Margus Tarkner and Anna Isabel Xavier, we are going to be asking them, where do we draw actually that strength to act from? And where do you think that comes from, Yevgenia?
Well, for Ukrainians, that's very easy, because we don't have any other option. We don't have a luxury to lose. So this national resilience that comes from a realization of the fact that we only have bad scenarios and worst case scenarios. We don't have a luxury of having great scenarios now. So even though it's going to be tough, we need to fight back. But for most of our European colleagues, and especially for many societies in the West, I think it's important to realize what happens if Ukraine fails. And that's what can bring a very different threat perception if we realize that there is no struggling Ukraine anymore, and then the Russian forces are not necessarily moving into European or NATO territories, but they increase all type of hybrid attacks that we can witness now. They move from disruption to destruction. That's not going to work for Europe as well. So that's exactly why we need to wake up to this new reality.
Right. And Mikhail, something that came up on the first panel yesterday also was the role of Central and East European countries in this. Because, I mean, what Yevgeny has said now, I say that kind of thing in Germany, and the federal president accuses me and people like me of being so-called Kaliber Experten, and warmongers in another phrase. But actually waking up to the danger, getting Germans to realize this is not someone else's problem. That's a message that's been coming so strongly from Central Eastern Europe for years now. Why isn't Germany listening, and why aren't other countries in Western Europe listening?
Well, I think the needle is moving, just again, slowly. And Yevgenia said that, you know, Ukraine has no other option. I actually think that we are kidding ourselves if we think that we have some other option. I mean, the fact is that if Ukraine was to lose, we would be facing a victorious Russian army on the borders of NATO. And we now are seeing that Russia is preparing to challenge NATO over a longer term, right? So Central and Eastern Europe woke up to this a long time ago. For us, February 2022 was a terrible confirmation of something that we have seen coming, you know, over a longer term trend. Now, it is, I think, especially responsibility of Northern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, leaders like Prime Minister Kallas, leaders like Donald Tusk.
One of your favorite prime ministers, I heard
she
yesterday.
She is. And it is true. Of course, now I'm a big fan of Donald Tusk as well. And Radek Sikorski is another very important voice to really alerting the whole transatlantic community to what is at stake. And what is at stake is, frankly, you know, we focus here in Tallinn on the European security, but the point we made also in the opening panel is that Ukraine and the European theater is just one of the theaters that is already on fire. The other one is the Middle East that is on fire. And actually, the next panel after our conversation is about Indo-Pacific. So we are in the midst of a global confrontation, perhaps global conflict. And of course, that kind of conflict will impact and is already impacting Germany and France and Western Europe. And it's a just question of whether all the societies and all the leaders react proactively, that's a bit of a misnomer, to this now, or whether we wait a little bit longer. The longer we wait, the higher the price will be.
Right, strategic dithering.
Absolutely.
Is raising the cost to all of us here.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting you mentioned Donald Tusk and Radek Sikorsky, because since they came into power, it's been much harder for the German government to ignore what is being said from Poland, because they haven't been able to dismiss the government as right-wing extremists, nationalists, Russophobes and Germanophobes in equal measure. You can't do that with Tusk and Sikorsky. But what we see is Berlin now hiding somewhere else, hiding behind Washington. So, Matt, what's the role of U.S. leadership on this?
Well, I think U.S. leadership is essential for NATO and also for the war in Ukraine. And I think the Biden administration has been a little bit too cautious when it comes to the war in Ukraine, of providing the weapon systems after they decided not to, aircraft. HIMARS, weapon system after weapon system. They thought it would be too dangerous, and then they decided to provide it. And even now, putting restrictions on the Ukrainians for using weapons against targets in Russia, which militarily makes no sense. If Russia has a sanctuary just across the border, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, for Ukraine to win the war. So I'd like to see the United States be more forward-leaning when it comes to providing weapons to Ukraine, but also on the question of Ukraine in NATO. I think the Biden administration and Germany have been more cautious on that issue than other alliance members.
Very, very diplomatically put, Matt. They've been actively blocking it. I mean, we know this was the key two in Vilnius and the key two who are still sticking there now. And the danger ahead of the Washington summit is that we see unity at any cost and unity around a lowest common denominator point.
Yes, and I think they think that last year, where expectations were built up for some big statement about Ukraine and NATO, and those expectations were not met. The Ukrainians were disappointed. So I think they very much want to avoid that this go around. My understanding is that what they want to talk about is a bridge to NATO, and then to try to—
Not an L bridge, listeners, just to be clear about that.
Yes, and Dan Fried, a colleague of mine, has said, well, a bridge is fine, but it needs to be made of steel. It needs to be short. It can't be a bridge to nowhere. And so I think, what does that bridge look like? I think will be important.
Absolutely. I mean, Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, Jan Masaryk, the Czech politician from years ago, famously said a bridge is what gets walked over, which is why the Czechs refused to be styled as a bridge in international relations. But here, indeed, there seems to be a need for temporary arrangements that can act as a pathway in, not an alternative to NATO membership. But much like on the case of supplying Ukraine with what it needs, until the US leadership says to the American people very clearly, this is our war and we've got to win it, I don't think we're going to get there, are we, Evgenia?
Yeah, I think strategic communication is really important, and that's what we lack now in many European countries, but also in the US, because for many people, that's still a war which happens somewhere there in Ukraine. And there is kind of two different types of Russia. One bad Russia, which is fighting in Ukraine, which is committing war crimes against Ukrainians. And then there is a not that bad Russia with which we can negotiate, which is still acceptable in many international platforms, in many forms. And this is not the case, because this is the same Russia in the Indo-Pacific that you mentioned, because there is Indo-Pacific fleet of the Russian Federation, the same Russia in the high north together with China, right? There is another aspect of strategic competition. And then the same aggressive Russia in Europe, which threatens not only Ukraine, but also many other European countries. And those countries which are exposed to this threat or which have experienced Russian occupation, like Estonia, where we have a museum of two occupations in Tallinn, that's pretty clear. But for some societies, for some countries which are further away from the front line, I think it's important for the governments to have this strategic communication to explain to their own people why this is our common war.
Yeah, absolutely. And Matt, just coming back to you on this, because you've recently written a book, which is called
We Win, They Lose: Republican Foreign Policy in the New Cold War.
Right, which is, of course, taking from a famous quote from Ronald Reagan from before he became president, when he said, complex things can actually be made extremely simple when you think them through. And we win, they lose, was the very clear message then, which led to the grand strategy of peace through strength combined with quiet diplomacy that actually brought an end to the Cold War. Is that what we need now?
I think it is. And that's what my co-author and I recommend. And because I do think we've seen since the war in Ukraine that the world is forming into blocks. I think we see that the free world is more united than we understood. Finland and Sweden joining NATO, Indo-Pacific allies doing a lot to help Ukraine. I think we're also seeing that this axis of revisionist autocracies is more united than we understood, with Xi and Putin just meeting this week, Iran and North Korea providing weapons to Russia. And so I think essentially we are in a new Cold War. And you know, people say, well, it's not exactly like the old Cold War, and that's true. But you know, World War II wasn't exactly like World War I, but they were still world wars. I think it is a Cold War, and I think the goal should be for the free world to win.
100% agree there on that one. But Mikhail, I mean, this is a message, again, we've been having from clear-eyed leaders like Kaja Kallas, from Gabrielis Landsbergis, from Margaret Sarkna, and others, and from the Polish leadership as well. But there seems to be a problem, and this comes to something that was mentioned in the opening panel. Still, when we think about European leadership, the default is to go to France and Germany. And we know, I mean, anyone who's got a sense of liberal purpose in the world knows that might doesn't make right. But in Europe, we still seem to think that size makes wise. Well, how can we actually start learning more from the Central Eastern European leaders?
Yeah, it's been taking a while, right? Because Poland and a few other countries have been part of NATO for 25 years. We've been part of EU for 20. Yet, I think it was President Ilves who pointed out that it was only Central European in one of the key posts for 1.5.
Yeah, 1.5 of the possible 20 appointments, I think, was the Ilves ratio.
That's right, because it was half of the term of Prime Minister Buzek, and then the other one was Donald Tusk. So, and we are now in both NATO and EU ahead of new series of important appointments. So the point was very much made that much more should be, that basically Central Europeans need to have, Northern Europeans need to have seat at the table of decision makers, decision shapers. Because I think another theme that we are talking here as well that is being recognized in our part of Europe especially, but also, you know, in elements, in parts of Washington, D.C., and in Ukraine, certainly, is that the current strategy of as long as it takes, or the Berlin version, let not Ukraine lose, it's not working out. This is something we absolutely, if we continue on that path, it is terrible for Ukraine that is bleeding out. It's a prescription for disaster. And Washington Summit is one of these moments that we have to change this. We are doing better as the alliance in terms of deterrence and defense, although still a lot to be...
Some room for improvement, isn't
for
there?
Improvement when it comes to regional plans, but really sticking to as long as it takes without having the end goal, and this is where we would need more of a leadership from the United States. Without that, we are not going to be in a good place,
right? Because whether it's as long as it takes or whatever it takes, the it is not spoken, and that's the we win, they lose part. So actually connecting these things, I think, is extremely important in the European discourse as well, which should then drive our actions, because the goal defines the means. When you've set the goal, off you go. But this seems to require a different model of leadership in Europe as well, not in terms of the style, but in terms of who's doing it, who's allowed to do it. Diffuse leadership, where there's some who are really setting the pace in Central Eastern Europe. Again, how, Mikhail, you want to come back in on that, but I'd be interested to hear from all of you. How can others so around the world encourage that and stop us defaulting back to the Franco-German motor, which is spluttering, to say the least?
Well, I think there is an alternative to the Franco-German motor. And the best thing that we can get in Europe for the moment is the Weimar Triangle. So Poland actually coming in, and Tusk has performed this role already, of bringing the perspective not only of Poland, but of Central Europe, of the Baltic states. Frankly, we have now great cooperation with the Swedes, with Finns, so bringing the northern eastern perspective as well.
Yeah, this North Central East European arc is really interesting, because the unspeakable East is put together with the unimpeachable North, which makes it terribly difficult for a lot of Western Europeans to ignore it.
Oh, it's great. We know this, including interesting conversation maybe over coffee on on rethinking nuclear sharing. But that's for perhaps another conversation. So that's the alternative we can have on the table. The problem, of course, is that we actually need each of the countries to perform its role. And Germany now is entering this moment of pre-election as well. So that's where I worry a little bit about the ability of all three countries to really provide the European leadership that we need.
Yevgenia, how do you see that?
Yeah, I think in many ways the center of gravity of NATO's defense and deterrence has moved eastwards and to the north as well. As you know, we have these coalitions of capabilities for Ukraine, and the Nordic Baltic states have been doing great. And very often that's also about setting the precedent and also about taking a leadership in some decisions which are not necessarily very easy decisions. So in Ukraine, for example, the first time when we heard about a possibility for Ukraine to actually have these deep strikes inside Russia's territory with the Western-produced weapons, that came from the Latvian foreign minister, Baiba Braža, and then from the UK Prime Minister Cameron when he was visiting Kiev. So
Former prime minister, current foreign minister.
Some people would argue
that point at the
moment. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. But that was absolutely crucial for us to hear, and that's how in Ukraine, I think this Nordic Baltic UK bridges that we've been talking about, they become more and more important, and that's where we see the actual leadership coming from many European countries.
Right, and indeed the UK does play a role here. So as well as the Weimar Triangle, there's another pillar there. And Matt, that's always been something Brits like to talk about the special relationship, which might be slightly overdoing it. It might be slightly one way, but nonetheless, the UK remains an important player and perhaps a channel through which Washington would like to work.
Yeah, definitely. The British-American alliance is so important. And the UK really has been a leader when it comes to the war in Ukraine out front still and providing long-range weapons. They were willing to provide that before the United States was willing to provide the ATACMS. So I agree with a co-panelist here that I think the center of gravity in NATO is moving north and east. And then I think part of the solution, too, of overcoming some of the German and French hesitance is American leadership. I think the Germans are hiding behind the White House and vice versa. And I think if the United States were more forward-leaning, it would be harder for Germany and France not to come along.
Right, absolutely. And of course, one of the classic missions of NATO was to keep the Americans in. And I think there's a common message around here that if we are going to keep the Russians out, then we need more of the America in, if also we are to drag the Germans up rather than keep them down as back in the day. Now, let's move forward looking to the rest of the conference. What are you each looking forward to in the sessions to come? Yevgenia?
Well, I look forward, first of all, to convey this message of urgency. This is really important, not only to take about the steps that need to be taken, but also to convey this message of urgency. As long as it takes doesn't work anymore, because it took long enough. And unfortunately, Ukraine is now outmanned and outgunned. So I do look forward to these discussions about what can be done now. And my second expectation is also not only to focus on what is going on the battlefield, but also to talk about geoeconomics, because there are so many different ways how we can curtail Russia's illegal and malign activities in maritime trade, in shadow fleets, in trade in looted Ukrainian grain, sanctions, circumvention of sanctions, dual use goods, etc., etc. So my expectation is that we will have this 360 degrees approach and also comprehensive strategy of how we can curtail Russia's war machine.
Right, absolutely. And we did ask Yevgenia to keep that list short, as it's a short show today, but it could have gone on. There are so many other things we can do. And let us not despair, but act. Well, let's get those options on the table. Let's act so we don't despair as well. I think we have to be able to invert that. Mikhail, for you, what are you looking forward to?
I would say also two things. One is connecting the dots across the different theaters. Our adversaries are connecting the dots. They are cooperating well. As Matt said, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. We need to do much better than them, and than what we are doing right now. It's still even in Poland. Actually, we look, for example, to the war in Ukraine as too isolated from the war in Gaza. I mean, often this gets lost. So I think that's connecting the dots is clear, and setting the strategy appropriately. That's one thing. And the second one is there is an upcoming conversation about NATO, and it's titled "What Do We Celebrate in the Washington Summit?" And I'm all about celebration. I love NATO 75 years. Great. But of course, it cannot be conversation only about celebration. And I hope, I'm sure that all three of us will push the panelists to say how NATO does need to change in the short time that we really have, as the threats are coming closer to NATO's direct border. Of course, the front right now for NATO is in Ukraine. But the threats are becoming more real, both in a hybrid way, but also slowly in conventional way as well, especially if we take a slightly longer perspective. So I hope to be pushing our panelists, including speakers from the U.S. government, on going beyond the kumbaya celebration of the upcoming summit.
Yeah, now's not the time for just a pure celebration.
Yeah.
We have to be able to draw strength from our past. We have to learn the right lessons from it in order to look to the future as well. And Matt, you've done a lot of work on Cold War strategic posture and so on. What would be some of the lessons you would actually draw from that period that maybe we've forgotten now?
Yes. Well, on lessons, I'll be speaking tonight on a panel of what are the lessons learned from the war in Ukraine. And for me, I think one of them is that major power war is possible. I was talking to a colleague who worked at NATO who said that even at NATO, a military alliance, he thinks that essentially in January 2022, the sense was that a major war in Europe was impossible. And now we see that that's not the case. And of course, Russia is reconstituting. It could attack a NATO ally. China has said that the military option is on the table for taking Taiwan. And so this posture commission I served on said that the goal for the United States and its allies needs to be able to deter and, if necessary, defeat China and Russia simultaneously. And I think we're nowhere near having the capabilities we need to do that. I think there are three pieces to it. I think one is relying more on nuclear deterrence, like we did during the Cold War. I think two is that the United States needs to greatly increase its defense spending. We spent an average of 7% of GDP on defense during the Cold War. Now we're at 3%. So we could double defense spending and still be, below our Cold War averages. And then third and finally, Europe does need to do more. And it's not just the Donald Trump who says that. I think there is a consensus in Washington and in much of the alliance that if we're going to get the capabilities we need for the new NATO regional plans, that the Europeans are going to have to do more.
Absolutely. And that points to, I think, some other lessons I would draw, which our listeners might be familiar with from other episodes as well, that we did spend a lot more on defense in the Cold War. We did actually get this together, but it came at a time when we actually had much higher social spending as well, because we were fighting that war on many fronts. We had to give our populations credible hope. We had to give them reason not to despair and show that this was actually in their interest. And I think you make the case for more defense spending. Well, we need to make it again to our populations, not only to see what winning means, but that winning is a whole of society theory of victory, that they actually understand why they have to be part of that. But tell us, Matt, just quickly, which other panels are you looking forward to, and which conversations do you want to have while you're over here in Tallinn?
Well, there are so many terrific people here, and it's a good couple of days, but I wish we had more time. So I'm looking forward to several of the conversations. I guess I am interested in hearing more how the Europeans are thinking about the endgame in Ukraine, as you talked about, because 2 years ago, I argued that the goal should be for Ukraine to take back all of its territory to win. But I'm afraid that we haven't done what's necessary, that we were too slow providing the weapons. We're still putting restrictions on Ukraine. And so, is that still possible? Or if not, then what is the alternative? And is there some kind of way to wind down the war along the current line of conflict, create the stability that would allow us to bring the western part of Ukraine into NATO and into the EU, and then work diplomatically over time to regain the rest? Again, I'd prefer that we just give them what they need to win. But if we're not going to do that, then what's the plan B?
Well, you'll be glad to know, Matt, we talked to Ben Hodges, Ewald Alder, Terry Schultz, and Alexander Daniluk about exactly that yesterday. And listeners, you'll be able to hear that on a future episode of Berlin Inside Out. What is the military pillar of victory in Ukraine? What does it look like? But Yevgenia, perhaps you'd like to respond to that quickly in terms of, yeah, we all think around this table we should be giving Ukraine what it needs to win, but we're not doing it. So where does that leave us?
Yeah, I think we should not only give Ukraine war to win now, but as you mentioned, we need to think in a long-term perspective of what the victory of Ukraine looks like, and that would be, of course, Ukraine in the European Union and in NATO, and that would also be a win-win scenario. So not only Ukraine wins, but also NATO wins, having on board very skilled, very experienced Ukrainian armed forces, and after having invested so much in Ukraine's defense and in Ukraine's economy, reconstruction and recovery, it just makes much more sense to have Ukraine on board rather than to leave it in a kind of a buffer gray zone for very vulnerable for further Russian attacks. So my message is very clear. Make defense spending great again. And that's, I think, here.
Message to our friends in Washington there, and one that Matt would hardly endorse, I'm quite sure. But this is right, Mikhail. I mean, this is the geopolitical opportunity of a generation for Europe.
Well, it is. Well, the stakes are very high because, you know, as we are sitting here in Tallinn, the first part of the sentence, of the motto, is let us not despair, right? So opportunity is there. But first of all, we are dealing with a real, very real threat. But yeah, I mean, if we can work this out, we are talking about enlarging Europe whole and free and at peace at the end of it, having our Ukrainian brothers and sisters inside. And really, that's what it will take in this, what has become a global struggle with authoritarians. It's just, I think we have a pretty tough decade ahead of us to make sure that we can do it militarily and politically. So, you know, I think Lennart Meri conferences will be interesting for the next decade or so, for sure.
They will, because it's a cliche, but when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And now we've got to show we're tough enough. Matt, Mikhail, Yevgenia, thanks so much for joining us on this Tallinn Side Out special edition of Berlin Side Out.